it please the court, good morning. My name is Mary Batt. I'm an assistant attorney general. With me at council table this morning is Patricia Brady, deputy general counsel for the University of Wisconsin. We are here this morning on the denial by the trial court and the court of appeals of the defendants, doctors Cooper and Stout's qualified immunity defense. We have seven issues that raise very significant and substantial questions to the University of Wisconsin and to the defendants. There is only one factual point that I would like to make to the court that I think is salient. Otherwise, since this is a motion to dismiss, the facts are very limited. We are simply here on the basis of the allegations and the plaintiff's complaint. The salient factor that I think needs to be pointed out is that there are actually four instructors involved here, not three. As I reread the briefs yesterday, I noted that the plaintiff admits that she told only two instructors, Drs. Cooper and Cook, about her manic depressive condition. I believe everybody agrees a reasonable inference is that Dr. Cooper then told Dr. Stout about the manic depressive condition. I point this out to the court because I think it is important for the court to note that there is no allegation whatsoever in Connie Powell's complaint that the disclosure to Dr. Stout by Dr. Cooper of her manic depressive condition in any way violated her right to privacy, or that she had any sort of a due process right at all in a hearing before Dr. Cooper told Dr. Stout. Simply bring that to this court's attention. We are here on her allegation that the decision that was made to require her to disclose her manic depressive condition to her site supervisor violated her constitutional rights. It is the defendant's position that no law clearly establishes that what these defendants did was wrong. As such, they are entitled to qualified immunity. The Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court made an error when they determined otherwise. A review of the case law is unanimous, at least insofar as I have found it, that academic decisions are not protected by substantive due process or procedural due process. As such, these defendants enjoy qualified immunity from suit. Their decision to require Connie Powell to make the disclosure to the practicum instructor, the same disclosure that she volunteered to Drs. Cook and Dr. Cooper, was an academic decision, and as such, there were no due process rights to which she was entitled. Again, the defendants enjoyed qualified immunity from suit for their decisions regarding academic matters.
Counsel?
Yes?
Is it a well-recognized that there is a constitutionally protected property right under state law to complete a graduate program?
In order to have a constitutionally protected property right, it would have to be recognized under state law. There is no law, there is no decision that recognizes in the state of Wisconsin a constitutionally protected, such a constitutionally protected property right.
I note that third paragraph, I guess, of the dissent in the Court of Appeals. The dissent is kind of a vigorous dissent and takes on the majority. But as to that premise, the dissent is in accord with the majority. It says that whether Powell has sufficiently alleged that she has a constitutionally protected property right under state law to complete her graduate program. If that's the real issue, now the dissent takes issue with what the issue is, but if that's the issue, whether there's a constitutionally protected property right to complete a graduate program, the dissent says would be unanimous because Goss recognizes that right. Are you saying both the dissent and the majority are wrong with regard to that?
Well, I would say that I believe they're in error.
Thank you.
When I look at Goss, again,
he's so kind to me, too.
when you look at what creates a property right, you have to look to state law. When you look to Goss, the decision that the dissent was referring to, and indeed the decision that all these cases refer to in determining such a right, one sees that Goss was decided under a Michigan statute, excuse me, under an Ohio statute. The Ohio statute related to a guarantee by the state of Ohio that everyone under the age of 21 was entitled to a free public school education. I believe Goss involved high school students who had been expelled for some sort of misconduct. And in that case, the court found, based on the Ohio statute, that Ohio had granted them a property right, which the federal court then determined was entitled to some minimal due process protection. I do not see that there has been such a decision in the state of Wisconsin. So I do not agree with the dissent or the majority in their interpretation of that. And again, that gets back to my position. When one looks at the development of the law, there has been no decision that has interpreted Wisconsin to grant such a property right to students, or that it is much less constitutionally protected. Again, that gets back to the defendant's position that their conduct is protected by qualified immunity. If one looks to the due process rights that the plaintiff is claiming, again, getting back to there has to be a property interest in order to claim a due process right. Well, Connie Powell, in her brief, indicates that she is not claiming a contract with either of these defendants. If we have no contract, there is no basis for a property right. So the due process argument falls on the basis that there is simply no property right involved. Substantive due process, if we look at the other analysis for due process, substantive due process, which would then be a review of the actual decision of Drs. Cooper and Stout to reveal this condition, has never been found by any court in academic decisions. When one looks to Ewing, Ewing assumed for purposes of argument that there was a substantive due process right, but it never found one. When this court looks to, I cited in my reply brief, the U.S. Supreme Court decision in County of Sacramento, when it talks about qualified immunity, it actually cautions the lower courts about their tendency to assume rights and then go on from that assumption to find or not whether or not they were clearly established. And the court noted there that the problem with that, insofar as it goes to state defendants, is it never puts them on notice what rights are clearly established and what aren't, so that they can know what they are violating.
You're talking about substantive due process?
I'm talking about substantive
due
process.
For me, I don't always know all this stuff, but I think of the buzzwords of substantive due process as being arbitrary and capricious. Is that correct? I mean, that's what's alleged in the amended complaint, too.
That is correct.
And then I look at the Frank versus Marquette case, and I'm reading from page 372. It says, the law is apparently well settled that a university, college, or school may not arbitrarily or capriciously dismiss a student or deny to him the right to continue his course of study therein. And then it goes on and then it cites a number of cases. Is the law well settled, as that opinion in Frank versus Marquette states?
Well, Frank was a contract action, I believe. It was not a 1983 action. It did not involve a constitutional question. So it may be well established when one is claiming a contract, that a contract can't be breached arbitrarily or capriciously, but neither Frank nor Cossio stand for the proposition that there is any sort of a constitutionally protected property right. Now, recall, Justice, that there can be property rights, there can be contract rights that can be constitutionally protected, but there are also a whole plethora of contract actions or contracts that one can have that are not constitutionally protected, when one looks at the case law that determines what is arbitrary and capricious, it is not a matter of was there some rational basis for it. When one looks at County of Sacramento that talks about substantive due process, what will trigger substantive due process, it requires purposeful oppression and abuse of power that shocks the conscience. I suggest to the court that is far removed from the line of cases that we have in Frank and Cossio under a contract analysis. Also, recall, Justice, there is no allegation here of tortious interference with contract. If there were any sort of a contract action involved here, there was a whole procedure that the plaintiff could have used, could have invoked to allege a breach of contract, and that would involve going to the claims board and filing, getting a claim denied or getting the claim paid, and then filing suit after that. This is not a contract action. She admits it in her brief, and as such, there's no property right involved here. Without a property right, there's no due process violation. Then when you look to substantive due process, there is no recognized right to substantive due process in any academic matter, and that gets us back to qualified immunity. The law is not clearly established that what these defendants did was wrong, and as such, they are entitled to qualified immunity.
This is kind of confusing to me. Now, you say she admits it in her brief that there is no contract action. Well, I look at the amended complaint, and there isn't any contract action. What there is a 1983 action based on implied contract, and that's set forth in paragraph 7 of the amended complaint, that it's her action is based on implied contract and is a 1983 cause of action as opposed to a breach of contract cause of action. How do you respond to that?
Well, I respond that there's a discrepancy between what she alleges in her complaint and what she admits to her in her brief. And in her brief, and my notes indicate on page 8, she claims no contract with either of these defendants. So I suggest Connie Powell cannot have it both ways. And I am going with what she states in her brief. And that is what I'm responding to and what I responded to in my reply brief, that she is not claiming a contract. Unfortunately, I devote a lot of time in my brief on the assumption that there was such a contract action. And much to my surprise, in her responsive brief, she indicated she is not claiming any such contract, and indeed, I think even went so far as to say, I waived any claim of making a contract argument against her. Again, I see that her procedural due process argument falls because the only property interest that I can see would be on the basis of a contract action.
Help me with this. If she alleged a 1983 action based on an implied contract, is that enough to get her into due process?
No, Justice. Again, then the analysis would have to be, is this a sort of a contract that is protected by due process? Recall the case law. One can be a university professor, employed, have a job, a constant in stream of income. However, if that person does not have tenure, that is not protected, that position is not protected by due process. So simply having a contract does not make it protected by due process. Indeed, the case law development indicates and actually cautions the court about trying to constitutionalize all contract actions and bringing the government and due process protections involved in any and every sort of contract that could be created between a state entity and an individual. When one looks at what sorts of actions contracts have been protected by due process, they have involved things like Social Security benefits, extreme dependency, Social Security, welfare has been another one. Those are the two that come to my mind offhand. But clearly, when we get to there is nothing at all when you look at the development of case law, what the court will review for either procedural or substantive due process, nothing reaches the level of giving a student a constitutionally protected right to tell actually two instructors and not tell a third and actually have three instructors know about it but only raise a claim against the fourth one knowing about it. Again, I don't want to harp on this point, but I would like to think I'm emphasizing it. There is no clearly established law that these defendants violated, and as such, their actions are protected by qualified immunity.
And that's the main premise that you're bringing home, is that that this case would turn on whether or not Powell had a liberty interest in keeping this psychological information that she was manic depressive from this other. She made that decision. That was her decision, not the university's. The university asked her, if I understand it, to disclose this. She refused, so that's the crux of this case.
Well, unfortunately, that's one of the bases on which the Court of Appeals chose to affirm the trial court's finding. However, as the dissent noted,
yeah, there wasn't any argument about that. There were, you know, that's what the
That's correct. Connie Powell never asserted it. And if Connie Powell never asserted it up until this case hits the Court of Appeals in 1999, it's inconceivable to me that these defendants should know in 1991 when this occurred that they would be somehow violating a liberty interest when she basically quit the program. She was asked to make the disclosure, required to make the disclosure, and she quit the program, never got back to these defendants. The concern that I think the court needs to be aware of is it opens the door to this sort of litigation is basically intruding into academia.
I'm somewhat confused here, Ms. Beth. Are you saying that even if the United States Supreme Court had said clearly and explicitly that people in this country have a constitutional right to an education, that would not govern Wisconsin law?
Well, it would depend. Now, the court has already ruled in San Antonio versus Rodriguez that there is no fundamental right to an education. There is nothing inherent within the Constitution that guarantees anyone a right to an education.
So your position, then, I take it, is that state law must establish it.
State law would establish the property interest, and then it would be up to the courts to determine what sort of process is due to that property interest. Right now, there is no case law that clearly establishes that. And again, since there's no case law, the actions of these defendants are protected by qualified immunity.
Well, we have said frequently that in Wisconsin, we've interpreted our Constitution so that everybody has a right to an education. Have we not? Just a case we heard last term repeated that.
I believe that was involving a secondary education.
We are not sure that we've ever limited it to secondary education.
I'm sorry?
I'm not sure that those cases ever limited it to secondary education. They may have. I quibble.
I can't speak to that, Justice. Insofar as a liberty interest, that question was raised again. When one looks at the case law that defines or that talks about liberty interests, this does not involve disclosure of medical records. This does not involve disclosure of any confidential information. Connie Powell was simply required to tell her fourth instructor the same information that she volunteered to the first two. And again, there was no actual disclosure involved here because no one was told. And even if we assume, simply for the sake of argument, that there was a disclosure, then one would have to look to who was it being made to. Was this a public disclosure? I suggest that the case law would indicate that this was not a public disclosure because it was only being made, required to be made to one person. One person who had a natural and a probable interest in her mental problem. There's no public disclosure here. And secondly, I would suggest to the court that Connie Powell waived any claim that she may have in keeping this information private because she volunteered it to Drs. Cooper and Dr. Stout. I get back to the point of the dissent here, that what this case comes down to is her drawing the line at two people and now claiming constitutional protection to tell two, but not the third one. How are these defendants to know that she had a constitutionally protected right to tell two people, but not the third one? Again, their actions were protected by qualified immunity because there is no case law that clearly establishes this. What the Court of Appeals did and what the trial court did was they took a general principle from Goss v. Lopez. We have a right to continue our education once we've begun. They took that general principle and they applied that general principle to a specific fact situation. The specific fact situation being she wanted to tell two people but not the third one. And somehow these defendants were supposed to divine that by making this disclosure to her, they were going to force her, or in effect, according to Connie Powell, require her constructively to quit school. I suggest to the court that if this court accepts that sort of argument, it goes down that path, it is going down the path that the Supreme Court in 60 years of case law have strongly urged the court not to do. Case law is uniform. Stay out of academic decisions. I can very easily envision cases where a law student maybe is required to take an advocacy course, and the law student decides, well, I don't want to do that. I'm going to be a corporate lawyer.
Can we decide this case on that point? Do we have sufficient facts in the record to determine that this was an academic decision as opposed to a disciplinary decision?
Absolutely. When one looks at the case law concerning practicums, concerning clinical rotations, the case law is uniform. All of these decisions are considered academic. There is no way I believe that this could be construed in any way disciplinary. When one looks at disciplinary, how discipline is defined in the UW Code, chapters 14 and chapter 17, it is always some sort of an action being taken. It is changing a grade, lowering a grade, failing somebody, withdrawing them from the school. It is something that is being imposed on them. It is not asking them to make a disclosure. I suggest that what these individuals did here was they tried to impose a condition on this plaintiff to help her succeed in this program.
How do we know that?
Well,
I'm saying, and my question means, how do we know that based on the four corners of the pleadings? And that goes to Justice Babbage's comment, do we have enough facts at this stage of the proceedings?
Yes, we do have enough facts. Again, the law is uniform. These decisions are considered academic, and they are protected by qualified immunity, so there is no further factual inquiry that needs to be determined. Secondly, when one looks at the case law, when you look at the development of the case law from Hortonville down to the present, the case law is uniform. These decisions of academic advisors, decisions of professionals in this type of discipline are to be afforded a presumption of honesty, a presumption of integrity, a presumption that they are looking out for the best interests. If this were not the case, the burden is not on these defendants to somehow come in. The burden is on the plaintiff in her complaint to set forth facts to show that there was something that took this out of being an academic decision. There was some illegal prejudice. There was some financial interest. There was something that would take this out of an ordinary academic decision, a criteria for entry into a program. There is no allegation. This is her complaint. We have been litigating this case for many, many years now, and I believe it is time to call it quits.
Well, another way to look at the directive here was to say, okay, Dr. Cooper and Stout say, you must reveal. And then Ms. Powell says, no, I will not. So then they say, all right, you're terminated. You're terminated because of your failure to reveal this. And I guess this is Ms. Powell's position. But that's discipline. That sounds more like discipline than it does academic decision-making.
I would suggest to the court that if this were an academic decision to terminate her, it would not be protected, and the case law indicates that. There is nothing in the complaint to indicate that she told them that she wasn't going to do this and they terminated her. That's reading facts into the complaint. What the complaint states is that they asked her to make this disclosure and she left school. And she left school in good standing with a 3.887 grade point average.
But what if we were to not grant your motion and then there's depositions taken and it turns out that Dr. Cooper and Stout decided to do this because they didn't like her and they had no basis other than that to force her to disclose? Now it's not an academic decision. Are you saying that under no, I guess another way of putting that question, are you saying that under no factual circumstances can this decision of Cooper and Stout be anything other than an academic decision?
The only way this could be considered anything other than an academic decision were if there was some sort of an allegation of illegal prejudice, financial stake in the outcome. I do recall one case, Justice, where there was an allegation that the professor had told the student, under no set of circumstances will I ever pass you. And in that case, the court found that that indicated a personal animosity, and they denied a motion to dismiss a complaint on that basis. That's the only case that I have found, and I can't claim my research was totally exhaustive, but it's been pretty exhaustive. That's the only case that I have found where anything along the lines of an academic decision has been found not to be totally within the discretion of the educators. And again, and I will wrap this up, it gets back to the caution that the United States Supreme Court, in 60 years of case law that in Ewing, I believe, or Horowitz, they pointed to, and they said, we're not going to ignore this case law. We're not going to get the judicial system involved in academic decisions and having justices determine what is the best criteria for entry into the department or for success. I get back, again, I want to emphasize, no law clearly establishes that what these defendants did in 1991 was wrong. And as such, they enjoy qualified immunity from suit, and the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals made an error when they denied the qualified immunity defense.
Well, they don't. Now you brought in another argument, I think. You're not saying that they're deserving of qualified immunity because this was an academic decision, are you? We don't even have to reach the issue of qualified immunity, do we, if we say that this was an academic decision?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Joyce, you have 30 minutes.
Justices, counsel, may it please the court. My name is John Joyce, and I represent the respondent, Connie Paul. I'd like to respond to some of the comments made by Ms. Batt, and I think I'll start with the last comment and the last exchange here about, is this an academic or is this a disciplinary decision? Well, of course, if you read our brief, we say it's a disciplinary decision, it's not academic. And if you look at all those cases that the appellate cite in their brief about all these situations where there were academic decisions, and you talk about somebody that was unkempt and unclean and sexually harassed other medical students, or somebody that failed their orals and their doctorate twice, or all of these occasions, you've got to find that they were in the internship program, and they did not live up to the standards of that program in some way, shape, or form. Or they went to a couple of hospitals, and they were canceled on their internship within a couple of weeks because they weren't conducting themselves properly. However you look at these academic decisions, they have something to do with the curriculum and the ability or lack of ability of that student to comply with those standards. In this case, with County Paul, you don't have that. You have a student who had a very high academic rating, had no prior problems. and talk about her quitting, rebelling, or whatever they want to call it, but in essence, she was told, disclose, or you cannot finish the program. Now, if you look,
just on the face of this, what is this program for again?
I'm sorry, sir, I can't.
This is just a test, by the way. This is all
Okay.
I wonder if I can, I think I can follow up on Justice Bappish's question.
Could you go over your version of the facts of exactly what happened in January 1991?
Well, our version of the facts is that in January 1991, she met with Doctors Cooper and Stout, and that we don't know, and we can't stipulate whether Cooper told Stout or not. We don't know that. And we don't know that she voluntarily disclosed her condition to Cooper. The only one we know she voluntarily disclosed it to is Cook. And we didn't plead there was a voluntary disclosure of her condition to Cooper. So all of this talk about she told two, why not three, is really not accurate based upon the pleas and the complaint, because we didn't say she voluntarily disclosed to two. So she goes to arrange her practicum in December of 1990, and she is told by Dr. Cooper, after Cooper finds out about her bipolar condition, that she cannot take the practicum.
What exactly is a practicum? What was involved?
Well, as I understand it, she goes out and actually does some practice in counseling with an institution, a hospital, or some other types of institution. So she's doing the type of thing that you would do if you had an internship in counseling and you went out and did counseling with somebody.
And did you say something in your complaint about the school having prior experience with someone who had a similar condition?
Well, we believe that to be true. We haven't had discovery in this case, but our facts are that they had prior experience with an individual that had a bipolar condition, and that turned out very badly. And we believe that it was their reaction to that prior bad experience that prompted them to impose this disclosure requirement on Paul. But that's an allegation.
Well, maybe this isn't in the record, but what should I infer from your reference to prior bad experience? Was the school embarrassed? Were clients injured? Was the site where the practicum was executed, were they upset? Or is there anything I can infer here?
Well, we don't know because we haven't had discovery what the result of that bad experience was. We only know that that is a fact that may exist. I think it certainly means that they were not trying to help her. They were not trying to encourage her to succeed. I think it means they were protecting themselves. You know, as such, all of their good motives may not at all be applicable.
And what is your position on what would have happened if the disclosure had been made?
Well, our position is that there was no determination whether disclosure should have been made. Our position on what would have happened if disclosure had been made is that she would have been stigmatized, she would have been watched in a different way than other people on their internship, and it would have affected her internship as to her ability, perhaps, to perform up to the standards that were required in the internship. Now, I don't know that, but she believes that and has experienced stigmatization from revealing this condition previously, and that was the reason she didn't reveal it. She was concerned about how she would be treated on her internship.
Tell me why this hypothetical is different than your case.
a student nurse. She's in a program to become a nurse, and this student nurse has a problem with alcohol addiction and drug addiction. And someone has information that this student nurse is a binge drinker and has other problems with drug addiction. Is that? And someone says, okay, you should tell the administrator about this, because the administrator would not want a nurse graduating from your program or from their program where the person is a substance abuser and then out working with patients in hospitals, patients in nursing homes. Isn't that the right thing to be telling the administrator of the nursing program about these addictions so that there isn't a graduation, so that this person isn't placed with vulnerable or unsuspecting patients? There's something compelling to me that says, yeah, they should know that. Isn't that your situation? And if not, please distinguish it.
Well, it's distinguishable because she never got into the program. We're not saying that if she got in the program and she didn't live up to the standards, and she had a problem with her disorder in the program and couldn't counsel, and had a problem with those she worked with, that would not be an academic decision at that point to say, okay, you're not complying with what we expect of you, and therefore we're going to take you out of that program. Now, we're not saying that isn't an academic decision, but she never got in the program. She was simply given an ultimatum, and under those circumstances, she never got a chance to show whether or not she could comply.
Just have a maybe question, a correction. If I heard you correctly, you said that in the complaint, your client only disclosed this to one party. That was Dr. Cook. Is that correct?
Voluntarily disclosed, yes.
But she did in your complaint on number 13, you indicate that the plaintiff disclosed to a Dr. Cooper that the plaintiff was suffering from manic depressive disorder.
Yes, we believe that she was told to do that by Cook, her advisor.
Okay.
That she was told, when it came time for the practicum, go to Dr. Cooper and arrange your practicum, and be sure you tell her about your problem. So it wasn't voluntary in the sense that she went in and said, oh, Dr. Cooper, by the way, you know, I have this condition.
Well, that's not in the complaint. I mean, you're just extrapolating from that.
Yes,
I assume
right.
if one read the complaint, it was always my assumption that your client had told at least two people, Cook and Cooper, about her condition.
Well, that's the assumption of the appellants.
No, that's your. I'm only reading from the complaint, which says upon disclosure to Cooper by the plaintiff, that's your complaint, that the plaintiff was suffering from manic depressive disorder.
All right, let's.
No, I'm not. I don't want to quibble, but I just.
Okay.
Counsel, do you have before you paragraph 12 of your complaint?
No, I don't.
Assume that paragraph 12 of your amended complaint reads, in December of 1990, the plaintiff was sent by plaintiff's academic advisor, Dr. David Cook, to speak with Dr. Arlene Cooper concerning the scheduling of plaintiff's graduate student practicum for the spring of 1991. Is that what you're referring to? That
I believe so. I didn't hear all of what you read.
I'm sorry. Paragraph 12 alleges that the plaintiff was sent by the academic advisor to speak with Dr. Cooper. Is that what you're referring to?
That's right. And that occurred in December of 1990, as we allege. Now, I think the difference is that she did disclose to two people, but how many of those disclosures were voluntary? You know, the only disclosure that we maintain was voluntary was the one that she made to Cook when she started this graduate program.
Counsel, as I understand it, we have here the arguments of, oh, there's a property interest and there's a liberty interest, and then we have to decide if there's a property interest in pursuing, being able to pursue this type of program, and then if so, it's clearly established, or is there qualified immunity, then we look at the liberty interest. Now, where in your complaint have you alleged a cause of action based on deprivation of a liberty interest?
Well, in the fact that we alleged that she was forced to disclose that condition, or that was an ultimatum. I think that's the construction that the Court of Appeals put on it.
Yeah.
They construed that from the fact that she was given that ultimatum. I didn't plead a liberty interest.
Yeah, that was the point,
yeah.
I'm getting to. You didn't.
No. I didn't plead a liberty interest. I don't disagree with the Court of Appeals, but I guess I wasn't smart enough to know there was a liberty interest. I went at this case from the standpoint of a property interest, which I think is clearly set forth in the case law in Wisconsin, and that was protectable by due process, procedural due process, which she did not receive. She didn't receive any due process. There was nothing that these two doctors, Cooper and Staub, did to investigate what, if anything, was the necessity to disclose her condition.
Why do you think it's well-established law that there's a property interest?
Well, I think it's well-established because you have the Frank v. Marquette case, you have the referral of that case in the federal court for the Western District of Wisconsin. Judge Crabb in that case refers to Chapter 36 and the rights for education under that chapter. In fact, Chapter 36 even contains a prohibition against denying education on the basis of disability. So there's a statute, I think, was in effect when this incident took place. So I think it's well settled in the state.
Do all of those cases, counsel, involve someone who is actually terminated or dismissed?
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Do all of those cases involve someone who is actually terminated affirmatively? Or dismissed affirmatively from an academic program? Or do they involve cases where a requirement was imposed which the student refused to comply with and then voluntarily quit as a result?
I think most of those cases, if I recall correctly, that are academic decisions involve somebody that is dismissed from a program.
Okay. So that's the distinction that we have in this case.
Pardon?
Your client was not dismissed or terminated. A requirement was imposed upon her that she didn't want to comply with, and so she didn't continue.
That's correct. She was not formally terminated from the program by getting a letter or an advice that she was no longer in the program.
Well, she wasn't terminated from the program informally either, was she? She simply wasn't terminated. She decided not to comply for her own reasons with the requirement that was imposed, and so those cases are perhaps distinguishable.
That's correct.
What do we have before us in the complaint? Because that's the only thing we're basing our decision on, is what's before us in the complaint.
Right. Correct.
And I don't know the answer to this, that's why I'm asking the question. Is it a word in the amended complaint that she wasn't allowed to continue the problem, the curriculum program? Is it averred that she quit? Is it averred that she was terminated? What do we have before us? Do you know?
I don't have the complaint in front of me, but I believe the allegations were to the effect that she was told to disclose or not continue, and that was in effect a determination as far as the allegations in the complaint. But I don't have the complaint in front of me.
And what you have in the complaint, at least in paragraph 18, the effect of said disclosure on plaintiff or any alternatives to said disclosure and was the arbitrary and capricious whim of the defendants and constituted a dismissal of plaintiff from her graduate program. Now, maybe there's something else in the amended complaint that I didn't see, because I'm just looking at it for this issue for the first time.
Well, the allegation is that by requiring that condition that she did not comply with it, it wasn't effective dismissal because she couldn't continue.
You allege, I guess, in paragraph 25 that she was not given the opportunity to complete her graduate school program.
Correct.
Counsel, do legal conclusions in a complaint have to be accepted as true for purposes of a motion to dismiss?
I don't believe so. I believe it's the facts that are essential.
Counsel, I'd like to move a moment to qualified immunity. Now, in order, as I understand the law of qualified immunity, if you don't have qualified immunity, if in fact the law is well settled. And here, at least, Cooper and Stout claim that the law, at the very least, the law is not well settled. They argue that there's even a right to a continual graduate education program, but as I understand their arguments, they're saying even if there is such a right, it's never been stated in Wisconsin case law. It certainly is not found in the Wisconsin Constitution explicitly or statutory law explicitly, and therefore the law, even if there is such a right, has not been well settled, and therefore they are entitled to qualified immunity. Now, how do you address that?
Well, by saying what the other courts have said, that the you cannot arbitrarily and capriciously interfere with somebody's education since 1932. And that has, the other courts have said, and I agree with them, well-settled law in this state.
But is it well-settled law in this state that she had a right to, a constitutionally protected right to a graduate school education? I mean, I'm not even sure of that, and yet you're asking us to say that it's a well-settled right.
Well, Judge Crabb has found that in the, as far as Wisconsin law is concerned, she's found Wisconsin law that says it's a right with the law school case, which is a graduate school.
You're referring to the Helston case?
To Martin v. Helston, right.
I thought your argument was, and I don't know for sure, but I thought your argument in part was, look, there's an implied contract here, and that there's a property interest in contracts and implied contracts, and that the that it has been settled that in the context of education there can be an implied contract. I mean, isn't the Frank case based on have a contract, you're arguing, I thought, the basis of the property right is the contract right. Am I wrong on that?
Well, cases seem to find a property right without going to the contract or promissory estoppel. You know, and this happened in Ewing in the Supreme Court. In fact, in that Michigan case, the defendants raised the question of contract and promissory estoppel, which the court essentially ignored all the way up to district court, the Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court didn't take it up, but still found that there was an assumption that there was this right in the law. And so I'm not sure at all that there is a necessity that the right be based upon contract or implied contract. I think it can, but I think exclusive of that, it can also exist. And it can exist under the Frank v. Marquette case and the statutes, particularly Chapter 36.
Your opponent said that you've waived any contract argument.
Well, I don't think that's true. I think what I said in the brief was the brief I was responding to said that we pled contract. I said we did not plead contract, and that it was not raised to my knowledge in any of the briefs until this point in time, and therefore should not be an issue here. But I don't recall pleading an express contract in the amended complaint. And that's all I was saying. That was seized upon as you can see, to argue that no contract, no property right, no due process. But I was trying to clarify what I believe we pleaded.
Could I ask a question? If an employer is seeking to employ an alcohol drug abuse counselor, would it be improper under any statutory law to ask a question about the condition of the plaintiff? The manic depressive disorder, would it be improper under any statutory federal or state law to ask point blank, do you have a manic depressive condition? Have you now or ever had a manic depressive condition?
I don't know. I believe it is improper, but I don't know. I don't think it would be proper. I thought you were going to ask if you could ask if you were an alcoholic. I don't think that's improper, but I don't know about the manic depressive. It has no real connection to the alcohol.
Maybe
or
improper
drug counseling.
Illegal is really the better term. Is it illegal to ask that question?
Well, I'm not going to say this because I don't know. I suspect it is because it has no relation to the job that he is interviewing for. In other words, it doesn't make any difference whether you have alcohol or drug or a manic depressive disorder, where it may make a difference whether you have alcohol or drug addiction, because that makes a big difference sometimes in what kind of counselor you are. So I it's not really related to the job.
Counsel, a variation on that question. What if your client's bipolar disorder had manifested itself in some way during the course of her practicum?
Sorry, ma'am, I just can't hear you.
If your client's bipolar disorder had somehow manifested itself during the course of the practicum in a way that hurt a client, would her practicum supervisor and therefore the university be responsible for that or liable for it legally or at least potentially?
If they didn't know, I don't believe so.
But here they knew, at least. Here, at least two people knew, according to the complaint.
Would they be financially liable? Is that what you're saying?
Right. If the client got hurt in whatever fashion, sued the university and its agents for whatever injuries may have occurred during the course.
I suspect they may.
And doesn't that put the university and the supervisors in question, the defendants here, in sort of a catch-22?
Well, I think it doesn't, because if you're going to go that way, then I think you need to sit down with County Powell and say such things as, how many of these have you had? How recently? What is their severity? Do you have any reason to believe they would interfere with your job? I mean, there was nothing like that done here.
Isn't that the whole purpose of requiring her to make the disclosure so the practicum supervisor can have that conversation with her in order to know and understand how he or she needs to supervise this
well,
student?
I think it would, without the other part of that, which is, if you don't disclose, you're going to lose your practicum. When that comes along, then I don't think it is something you can relegate to the practicum. I think it's a due process situation, and you've got to give her due process by finding out at a very minimum what the repercussions would be from this particular disorder for this individual. You can't treat her as a label or a definition. It was mentioned that this could have been taken to the claims court. You know, I'm not sure that's true at all, because I believe that in this case we're suing Drs. Cooper and Stoud, and I think that court is relegated to the state of Wisconsin or the university as a defendant. So I'm not sure claims court would be an appropriate alternate remedy. I have nothing further.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Joyce.
Thank you.
With that, you have 5 minutes.
Could I ask, if Connie Powell were interviewing for a job, would she have any protections under the Americans with Disabilities Act from answering a question?
I can only answer that with respect to 1991. And in 1991, the ADA, when this occurred, the ADA had not taken effect. As a matter of fact, the case law that developed, it's cited in my brief, there was a dental student with HIV, and the dental school found out about the HIV status and disenrolled him. And that was found to be an academic decision. Now, I don't want to go down that path because that was before ADA, and I'm not familiar with ADA at all. I'm simply talking about the status of the law in 1991 that these defendants had to base their decision on. I wish to point out on page 26 of their brief, they indicate that appellant Cooper was told by the respondent she had a bipolar conditions, but there are no allegations the respondent told anyone else except Dr. Cooper, except Dr. Cook, her advisor. So in their brief, they admit that she told Dr. Cooper and Dr. Cook. And then they also go on in the very next sentence and they say, assuming Dr. Cooper told Dr. Stout, which would be a reasonable inference as he took part in the meeting of January 21st, 1991. So here we have the disclosure, which I think is reasonable, from Dr. Cooper to Dr. Stout. There's no allegation that that disclosure violated any privacy rights. There's no indication that disclosure was subject to any sort of due process protections. Again, it's only the claim that somehow telling the practicum instructor the same information violated her privacy, violated her liberty interest, violated her right to her substantive due process rights. I would point out in her complaint on page 7, she alleges a contract that was breached by the defendants. The contract that was claimed in the complaint is what then led to my contract analysis in my brief and was met with the claim by Connie Powell on page 8 of her brief that the respondent does not believe a claim of contractual relationship was raised in her amended complaint. Again, I get back to if there's no contract, there's no property.
Page 8?
I'm sorry?
It's on page 8 of her brief?
Page 8 of her brief, yes, yes. The last full paragraph. I think it is very telling.
Are you sure you're referring to her Supreme Court brief? I don't see that anywhere on my brief.
There are two paragraphs on page 8.
Well, read the language.
Read the language that you're referring to.
The respondent does not believe that a claim of such a contractual relationship was raised in her amended complaint.
What line does that appear on, approximately?
That is the second sentence in the second paragraph. There are only two paragraphs on that page.
No. Oh, sure. Justice, it's right here. We don't have.
We don't have that.
You know, I'm sorry. I believe Connie Powell filed two briefs. Maybe I'm looking at the first one. There was one that was rejected by the court initially.
Well, she did two briefs. One was rejected because of margins and a couple other technical errors.
Well, then, so it may appear on a different page.
So it may be on a different page. I have it on page 8. I have it cited. I don't know if you can look in your appendix. I have it cited right after Reed versus Village of Shorewood.
Yeah, and that's on page 8.
Is that page 8?
Yeah, right after that?
Yeah, then there's a paragraph that starts, appellants contend that respond.
It's on page 9.
I'm sorry, page 9. I'm sorry.
I've been looking at page 8 all day, but I couldn't find it.
Okay. All right. Gotcha.
I would also like to point out that I believe Connie Powell received all the due process that she was entitled to. When one looks at the development of the case law, one sees that for an academic, for a disciplinary dismissal, in other words, you're cheating, you're throwing rocks, you're dealing drugs. Disciplinary dismissal, the case law says, all you are entitled to is notice of the charge, either written or oral, and an opportunity to hear what your evidence is with the instructor. And that can be done all in one fell swoop. There's no prior notice required. It can be done at one sitting. That's it. And that's for a dismissal for disciplinary reasons. When one looks at what is one entitled to for academic, Horowitz indicates that a no hearing is required whatsoever. Connie Powell had the opportunity to talk with Dr. Cooper about this requirement. It appears from the reasonable inference from the pleadings is that Dr. Cooper went to Dr. Stout, her superior, for a second opinion as to whether or not this was required. Dr. Stout agreed with her. Connie Powell was in a meeting in January with Drs. Cooper and Dr. Stout. She had that opportunity to talk to them, to ask for their evidence, and to find and to refute it. And what did she do? She quit school. There is no clearly established law that indicates in 1991 that what these defendants did was wrong. As such, they enjoy qualified immunity pursuit.
Thank you, counsel. That terminates the argument in the second case of Powell versus Cooper. The court will stand recessed until the court of the Chief Justice at 2 o'clock. 2. Thank you.